Welcome, or welcome back. This is the second episode of Season 3 of the Primrose Chronicles, the podcast project dedicated to causing folks to long for the good old days of the 50s and 60s, even if they've never experienced it personally. If you're catching this when it first hits the airwaves, the week of 3/18/24, you're part of an unofficial birthday party. The Primrose Chronicles podcast turned 2 years old this week, so celebrate with me. Cake and noisemakers not included. I'm your narrator and host, septuagenarian contrarian Marty Young, and I'm glad that you're in this listening audience today. In truth, I guess I could be talking to myself. I have no idea the characters, locales, or numbers of same that are tuning in. My fragile ego has me imagining a countless throng, but it's only after I check my server stats that I'll probably come down to earth. Today, as I record, I am in anticipation of rivaling Joe Rogan in market share with this tale, delivering it with the folksy charm of Garrison Keillor. Even before the approximately 30 minutes of sharing, though, I'll be back to appreciating the opportunity to reminisce and grateful for the few of you that are joining these faithful ranks. I can only hope the images conjured up will be as entertaining to others as they will likely prove therapeutic to this raconteur as he shares. The TPC playlist counts this installment 302, but in fact, I've only cranked out a little over 60 of these half-hour or so vignettes. The number 3 for third season and 02 indicating I'm still in the single digits of these podcastic efforts. At least 302, though, sounds like a well-produced number with plenty of history, and now that I've given you the explanation, it's not a total fabrication. Following that transitional installment of 301 that bridged a couple of past recollections with a very recent stint in the hospital, I return today, and I promise to continue for as long as this season progresses, into the decades that have been the hallmark of the first couple of extended efforts of 2022 and 2023. The variety of Primrose personalities that I was able to introduce you to in 2023 prompts me to continue to bring you Chronicle characters in 2024. The 9 conversations that I had are among the most listened to in the series, so I'd be crazy to go away from that. I'm excited soon to share with you who's lining up to join me behind the mic in future weeks, so watch for that announcement and updates throughout the year. As you may have noted last installment, I'm really finding it these days difficult to not offer comparisons of then and now as I unpack the memories. So don't be surprised to find us jumping back and forth, often with a foot in each era. That's not to highlight my cantankerous, contrarian nature, as much as to draw distinctions that might resonate with more who don't have the common connection with 50 or 60 years ago, but might appreciate another generation's sense of nostalgia, rather than brushing it aside for the sake of the new, bright and shiny, and the great, big, beautiful tomorrow that's just a dream away. Some of you will catch that latter phrase, because it holds its own wistful remembrance for Disneyophiles. Anyway, having explained my course going into this season, let me take you into the topic du jour. I'm really surprised that I'm only now bringing it to the broadcast. I've gone into detail on so many seasonal activities and holidays and annually occurring events, locales long past as well as characters, but somehow I skipped this one topic. It was, in fact, a staple of a youngster's calendar year-round, at least during the elementary and even early junior high years. It was available weekly, seldom missed, even serving as the centerpiece for birthday celebrations put on by weary or lazy or non-creative parents. In truth, like most kids, in nearly every town across the nation, I was in the theater audience most Saturday afternoons, summer, fall, winter, or spring, for the kiddie matinee. It was the one frequent activity that we could look forward to regularly. Where Christmas came and went and became the source of longing for at least 11 months following, and where Easter break did not always bring with it spring temps and included sometimes awkward family gatherings around meals and church services, and where the 3 months of summer vacation seemed so distant when the school year began and became boring far too soon into its occurring. Where holidays celebrated dead presidents or dead turkeys or dead tired workers, think Labor Day, with a day off school that might offer an opportunity for parents to create a list of tasks for their offspring much longer than the hours even afforded. A constant in all the year was the Saturday program of big screen presentations, combined and geared to the youngest of the picture house patrons. The 2 hours plus when the throngs of crumb crunchers filled the seats were pretty much without adult supervision, and we were on our own, in our element and feeling like royalty. And it's that singular but regular activity that I want you to travel back with me into for the next several minutes. It's hard to believe that usually protective, hovering, helicopter mothers felt comfortable leaving their charges at the curb in front of an establishment that was known for limited chaperoning of noisy, bratty kids filling every seat in a dark and spacious area, known for having a carpet of popcorn and aisles sticky with soda. But they did. Certainly served as a respite for my folks. While Mom was slow cutting the apron strings and letting me attend with others in the neighborhood, after a while, she set not just me, but my sister in tow, and later, my brother Dave. I quickly learned that I could hand off the two quarters to Nancy, and she could get Dave and herself through the turnstile. She'd then stand with other girls in her class at the concession stand, placing her little brother along the wall in the lobby while she purchased popcorn candy and fountain drinks for the two of them, with the other two bits that I'd passed to them from Mom as well. Her last babysitting task was to put her second-grade offspring in a seat, on the aisle if possible, among others of the primary set, instructing him to stay put until she collected him at the end, when they walked out together to meet me on the sidewalk and await the Mom taxi. She had learned that from my similar treatment of her when she likewise became my responsibility a few years before. Over time, I was even freed of that responsibility, though, riding my bike with my buddies, and Nancy became the holder of the family coins. And then Jim moved into the low man on the family totem pole. I can only assume that the littlest brother, Bill, brought up the absolute rear in this rite of passage. Although, as we moved into the late 50s and early 60s, Saturday morning television fare began to draw its own audience away from the neighborhood movies, regardless of the Technicolor and VistaVision that it offered. I seem to recall that by the end of the 60s, there were still movies, but mostly it was the same as the evening fare, just at reduced prices. I guess we baby boomers came along at the end of the movie house phenomenon. I remember my parents speaking fondly of the days when they were dating, and before that even just hanging with others who remained lifelong friends. Central to those movies were their seemingly weekly times at the theater. Mom spoke of the special nights when she was a teen that they tried to make a point of attending, she and her girlfriends, regardless of what was showing. She spoke fondly of Free Dishes Thursday, when every lady in attendance got that week's ceramic bowl, plate, or table item, simple white to match earlier week's offerings. And the goal? In about 4 or 5 months, she would have 6 or 8 place table settings. As a teen, my mother deliberately began her collection for her hope chest by regularly joining the other women in attendance, each with dreams of filling a future dining room china cabinet, even if a groom was not yet identified. Throughout our times at the family table, whenever there was a need for liquid topping, there was the ivory boat from one of those nights at the cinema, filled and refilled with simmering gravy. Mom and Dad both recalled that it was at a movie house on an early December Sunday evening that the feature film was stopped, and the manager came to the stage to announce that a U.S. naval base in Hawaii had been attacked by squadrons of Japanese airplanes, resulting in untold casualties, and our president would be addressing the nation that next day. The theater promptly emptied, and the shaken patrons went to homes and churches, many in tears, wondering how the conflict over there would now draw America in, and what would be the response in terms of young men enlisting and whole communities moving to a military footing. Following war years, the neighborhood movie houses became, for those still at home, a connection with the reality of the war effort, with newsreels filled with updates and movies churned out to either remind their viewers of the valor with which the members of our armed forces were serving, or slapstick, mindless comedies to take the minds off the same efforts, at least for a couple of hours. By the time in the mid-50s, when I became a young theater patron, there were basically two venues that I could frequent. The closest was the Uptown, on College at 42nd Street, and the slightly more distant Vogue, farther uptown, still on College, but at the western edge of Broadripple Village, its boulevard, also known as 62nd Street. Thanks to a few historical websites featuring Indianapolis landmarks, I came across some interesting tidbits regarding their early years. And since I have over 2,500 words before I need to start worrying about excessive length of this episode, I'll share a few of them. The Uptown Theater first opened in 1926 and thrived as an occasional inexpensive escape for cash-strapped middle class when the Depression hit. So named because it was on the north side of an expanding Naptown skyline, it had a rich legacy, having been designed by the firm who had previously constructed the Indiana Theater and the Circle Theater downtown. It had one screen, seated nearly 1,000 folks at a showing, and first-run features usually premiered downtown and then, dependent upon popularity, in a week or two, made their way to the screens of the suburbs. Again, on the north side, it was the Uptown or the Vogue. The latter had by far the more glamorous history, even with a later opening of 1938. Story has it that its name was suggested by film stars Mary Pickford and Buddy Rogers to the Vogue's manager during its construction, and Hoosier Cowboy star Ken Maynard laid the cornerstone at a public ceremony. It had a slightly smaller seating capacity, about 800, but surpassed the Uptown in its lobby, paint scheme, street-side facade, modeled after Hollywood architecture, seen only in these parts on the newsreel clips announcing world premieres and the attending celebrities. In fact, at the Vogue's opening, glamorous actress Carol Lombard and her boyfriend Clark Gable were in attendance. A bronze star was laid in the concrete out front, featuring the signatures of the famous couple, as well as 26 other movie stars with Hoosier connections. Well, as my word count marches on, I'm not going to name them all, but I'll just say it is an impressive list worthy of your own investigation. Apparently, the star was actually removed before I ever started frequenting the Broadripple landmark, seemingly lost when the theater's ownership changed hands, only to return in the 1970s, where it can still be seen today. Maybe someone in the audience would like to feature the Vogue's bronze star in his or her blog, podcast, or 5 a.m. story. For this effort, though, it's time to turn the telling to your host's own attending of that singular event in the week, familiarly called the Kitty Matinee. So come on and join me inside. If you made it to the ticket booth at the sidewalk entrance, it means that you either had joined a bunch of your friends in one of the Mom Squad vehicles and caught a ride to be dropped off curbside, or maybe you're a little older and your folks had finally expanded your travel boundaries to include those two entertainment sites. You had your own two-wheeled transportation, and you were free as a bird. If so, the community bike racks are on the side of the building, so don't forget to lock it or find a friend whose chain and padlock you can share. I say if you made it, because the coins needed some weeks were hard to come by. And there was always the possibility that some creative fundraising would be necessary in order to get there on Saturday afternoon. Seldom did our folks just hand us two bits for a ticket and another quarter for a drink, popcorn, and candy. As they said, "What do you think, that we're made out of money?" And to further make their point, they reminded us that money did not grow on trees. Some of us depended on allowances earned for doing household chores satisfactorily, but there were items that you couldn't live without that would take precedent, and for a brief while, you would need to seek other revenue sources. Newspaper routes, leaf raking, snow shoveling all became other means of income, but if worse came to worse, we were always on the lookout for empty pop bottles. Pepsi, Coke, 7-Up, Fanta, they all brought the same 2 cents. Discarded in the alleys or left behind garages by sweet old ladies who didn't want the hassle of taking them to the grocery for redemption, it was a least desirable, but at least legal means to gain the necessary funds. A blatantly illegal, but occasionally necessary, means of gaining entry into the big show required one member of your gang. Yes, with this activity, your participating buddies were worthy of a nefarious identification. Required them to enter by the front doors. Pooling your bottle deposits or loose change scrounged from family auto ashtrays, one went by the ticket booth and through the turnstile with a legitimately purchased ticket in hand. He sauntered past the concession stand down the side aisle to the dark, short, curtained hallway with the emergency exit sign above. It led to one of the doors with crash bars leading to the rear or side parking lot or an alley. For those younger in our listening audience, in those days, these were determined by management to be necessary for fire code, but not really connected to any alarm systems. And because of that fact, the gang member who had paid to get in slipped behind the curtain briefly, long enough to push the door ajar, just enough for waiting cohorts to slip in. Without waiting, he slipped back into the main movie hall, into an empty seat before being observed, hopefully, to nervously watch the program in a darkened theater. Now, if ushers were doing their job, being attentive to their surroundings, you were, in fact, busted. Parents were called, and you were banned from the establishment for a significant period of time. In truth, there were neighborhood rings that had it down to a science and seemed rarely, if ever, caught. Just dumb luck kept me from getting strong-armed the one or two times I succumbed to peer pressure. And as I heard just enough tales of derring do that went awry, I generally entered with the masses, with others, to fend for themselves and begin their own lives of crime. So today, you're with me, going through the front doors. The crowd is already gathering, many of them you know from school, but at the Uptown, Public School 66 and St. Joan of Arc also were well represented as we put down our quarter and noisily made our way to the concession stand. There lie the source of major choices. What to get that would tide you over and get you through the 2 to 2.5 hours of varied entertainment? Well, the popular choice was certainly popcorn. But buttered or no? Salted or no? That decision might depend on how recently it had been popped, and thus how fresh and fluffy it might be. You needed to remind the teens behind the counter to put an extra pump of hot butter in the middle of the bag as they filled it, but still slather it on top of the heaping serving. And if you've done that, don't forget your napkins. I don't know about you, but I was really into buttered popcorn until in upper elementary and early junior high school when I began thinking that I might be joining a girl mid-show. And with the chance of holding hands, I said no to the oily topping, figuring that my sweaty palms would be bad enough. Again, full disclosure, most of the time I went through the entire matinee without butter or female companionship. I don't know what I was thinking. Anyway, if you've selected popcorn for a dime, you may still have some change for the candy counter. It was something about movie theater candy. You could not find those brands in most drugstores or Five and Dimes. Think back with me. How many of them can you name? You don't have to like them. Only remember them. Some, obviously, more fondly than others. I'll start. Not an exhaustive list, but certainly representative of the counter shelves lined with snacks. No particular order at this point. How about the dime boxes first? Milk Duds, Juju Fruits, Boston Baked Beans, Junior Mints, Whoppers, Lemon Heads, Goobers, Dots, Red Hots, Mike and Ike's, and Good and Plenty. And it was hard to believe that many candy bars had both a dime and a nickel version. Snickers, Milky Way, Three Musketeers. And I'll refrain from mentioning the disgusting ones that contain coconut, but you know which ones they were. Then there was the taffy and the caramels on a stick for a nickel. Big Daddy and its chocolate-dipped counterpart, Black Cow. Both perfect if you had little money after your ticket and with a long show ahead. Necco wafers, Bit of Honey, and even Smith Brothers cherry cough drops. Now you finish the list. With your final dime from your quarter devoted to refreshment, you could get your soda. Paper cup. Lid, straw, containing ice, plenty of ice, Coke, root beer, orange soda, or 7-Up, identifiable only by color since carbonated water made up the majority of the flavor and, if prepared by the counter crew too early, was sufficiently watered down to even further make it unrecognizable. They certainly didn't match up with the quality you counted on at the corner drugstore, whether it was vanilla or cherry Coke or Green River, but you had to have something to wash down the rest of your haul, right? Now you again join the rabble that was making its way to customary areas of seating. They were not formally cordoned off, but over time, even from older siblings, you pretty much sat in a prescribed area according to school and grade. And with that, the lights dim and then fade to relative blackness. In an earlier decade, there might or might not have been a current event newsreel. Actually, it was rather doubtful for the kiddie matinee. They knew their audience. That meant possibly some trailers, which were the short clips advertising coming attractions. But soon the cartoons began to roll. Dependent upon the archives of a theater, we might see black and white merry melodies or silly symphonies, but by the mid-50s and following, to compete and draw folks away from the 12-inch screen in most living rooms with the three channels, the move was more into color offerings. And so in addition to the screen size, that set Uptown and Vogue and the like apart and made each of them a preferred destination. Again, I'll give you my list and you can add to it. There was Looney Tunes with Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Elmer Fudd, and the like. Also Woody Woodpecker, Heckle and Jekyll, Tom and Jerry, Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. The list seemed endless. Disney main attractions usually were preceded by Mickey, Donald, Goofy, Pluto, and the club. There were many others, repeated many times, but still reacted to with laughter, and even with the antics replicated in the theater rows and later in yards and homes ad nauseum with injuries, in fact, far exceeding any results that were on the screen. Following the animated shorts, unless it was a cavalcade of cartoon Saturday, came either a live-action comedy short or an action-packed adventure serial. Those developed to bring you back next week to see how that particular circumstance turned out for the dashing hero, the dastardly villain, the imperiled heroine. It was this Saturday afternoon entertainment roundup that I first learned of the Three Stooges, the Little Rascals, the Bowery Boys, and the like. Captain Marvel, Buck Rogers, and a host of cowboys in white hats took on their nemesis, escaping the predicament that they had been left in the week before, only to find themselves, their girls, or the whole town facing another catastrophe that we'd have to wait until next weekend to discover the successful conclusion. And with the cartoons and the serial behind us, with perhaps a brief intermission during which a variety of cartoon popcorn boxes and soda cups danced across the screen, encouraging one and all, who still had coins in their pockets or clutch purses, with the catchy little ditty, "Let's all go out to the lobby, let's all go out to the lobby, let's all go out to the lobby and get ourselves a treat." Yes, I am into voiceovers. Well, the lights then came up for just a few minutes. For most of us, I'm sure including you, it also gives us a opportunity to locate the targets of our Lemonhead and Boston Baked Beans projectiles, whether it was a classmate or a girl who was the object of our attraction, or an obnoxious usher just on general principles. If we had bought a box of either, that was probably its purpose. And the tension for the management between selling just a few more snacks and drinks and quelling the shower of candy bombardment was determined by how rowdy the crowd and whether the missiles were including half-chewed juju fruit. This was also the chance for the projectionist, who in retrospect I think hated Saturday matinees, to change the larger reels and await the signal from the manager to start rolling again. Down came the sconce lights, and the screen was again lit up. Might be a roaring lion, a majestic mountain, or a female symbol of liberty, but each meant to all assembled, it was now time to seriously settle in. Probably like you, I was more captivated by the action than the title, so I can't name too many that I saw, several more than once. But there were the genres of the westerns with their cowboys like Hopalong Jean and Roy. Another week, it could be a crime story set in the roaring 20s or a large metropolitan city or the like. One thing for sure, the cowboys and the cops were totally good, and the wrestlers and the robbers were thoroughly bad, and we learned a lot of our morals from those tales. Yet another might be the horror genre. Suddenly, following the opening credits, we'd be greeted by a giant gorilla or lizard or an army of invading space aliens or just a nondescript but still menacing, growing, glowing globule, ever-advancing, ever-consuming living flesh, seemingly without remedy. And then there were the confusing mixes of comedy and terror, where your favorite comedic duo or trio came face-to-face for over an hour with one of those Halloween horror characters. Too vague? Think Abbott and Costello meets Frankenstein, Wolfman, Mummy, Dracula, and the list goes on. No matter the subject matter, though, like every good thing, it had to come to an end. The lights came up. We all went into the brighter afternoon sun. Some waited for their rides home. The rest of us unchained our bikes and made our way home on conveyances that now transformed into horses, rockets, police cars, or tanks, dependent upon what was freshest in our mind's eyes. And arriving home, we'd replicate the antics of stooges with pokes and punches and swinging props. The buildings became backdrops to gun battles, enemy army attacks, or lurking monsters, all extensions of what had passed through our senses and into our imaginations. It does cause me to wonder if kids today would even enjoy Saturday matinees as much as we did back in the 50s. Probably not, I suppose. Children now have become much more sophisticated with PlayStations and electronic games and VRs and personal phones, all replacing the simple pleasures of yesteryear. There I go, lapsing into contrarianism, I know. So I think I'll stop now and just let you rest in the idyllic recollections of times, probably not necessarily that happy and peaceful, just dependent upon whether we choose to look in the right or wrong direction. That will be evident as the next installment wallows in the throes of a high school baby boomer's unrequited love. A relationship that really never got off the ground as far as the object of my affection was concerned, and I've entitled it All Dressed Up for the Dance. A sorrowful tale. From the memory bank that actually in its telling will bring a smile or even a chortle, and make you grateful that it happened to another Primrosian and not to you. Till then, check the Thursday entertainment page and see what's showing at the Uptown or Vogue. Maybe in the small print of the ad, they will let you know what Saturday afternoon holds. Oh, wait. It'll have to be solely in our memories. The Vogue is now a comedy club and a concert hall, and the Uptown was demolished almost 25 years ago. You know the lament. They paved paradise and put up a parking lot. So much for living happily ever after. Kind of gives the Chronicles its own purpose, doesn't it? Till next time, blessings. from Primrose Lane, or Primrose Avenue.